Rob Wolf, Andy Dees, and the whole nine. Today we are blessed. I'm going to use the word blessed today to be joined by Melissa in Dallas. What's up, guys?
Hey.
How's it going?
Thanks for having us.
Well, you know, it's going okay. I had technical difficulties, so they've been waiting for me to start the recording for an hour. So I think
I've actually gone three workouts and people waiting for you.
I could make a joke about the Hawaiian sectionals, but I'm not going to do that right now. So anyway, Dallas and Melissa, we're super stoked to have you guys on the show today. Rob's not actually going to talk for the whole hour.
I'm just going to eat so I can do my mass game.
Rob, you know, someone actually emailed me and wanted to know if I actually pay attention to when you're talking, because they commented that some of your answers were so long that they have a hard time paying attention.
Dude, nice. I don't know what I'm talking about halfway through any of my answers. I can't believe anybody is still listening. So
it's amazing you still work here. Well, anyway,
as soon as Nikki figures out a way of firing me and replacing me with Raul the pool boy, I guarantee it will happen. So
we're going to put Keystone in charge. Keystone's in charge.
He's much better qualified, I guarantee it.
So anyway, Rob and I will rant. We'll talk forever if we don't get focused. So Dallas and Melissa, whole nine. We thought first you would give you guys a little chance to introduce yourselves, talk about what it is you do. I'm not sure that everyone that listens to the podcast is familiar with your work. But we are huge fans. You guys love your blog. We also love the formerly blog written by Melissa that is no longer operational, which I missed your favorite famous post, like on the crazy train to Carrot Town, which I think is your finest piece of work.
Absolutely. Thank you. Yeah, you guys have referenced that one before. Thank you. We actually just reposted that on the Whole Nine site. You know, we kind of just transitioned the Urban Gets Diesel blog over to Whole Nine. It got really complicated to kind of write for both places. And the flavor of the stuff we write on Whole Nine is the same, somewhat irreverent, mostly professional, but we keep it clean for the moms now. So we've cleaned our language up quite a bit in the last couple of years. It's good stuff. So, you know, we, Dallas and I have been training together and working together in a nutrition and training and fitness capacity for about 4 years. We owned a CrossFit affiliate for a year called CrossFit 603. That is now defunct. But the kind of thoughts and motivations behind the affiliate still, we realized as we were working with our clients, we started to put into practice our theory that nutrition is the absolute foundation and the baseline of all good health and fitness goals, performance-related goals, body composition. And so we realized as we were doing the affiliate stuff and working with our clients, they started getting much better results when we started putting a big focus on nutrition as the foundation. So we transitioned away from the affiliate and we transitioned into the Whole Nine, and Dallas is going to talk a little bit about kind of how that came to be and what our thoughts are. But yeah, we're real happy to be here with you guys. Thanks for having us as your first ever, I think, guests.
You were the obvious choice to go with, and also everybody else declined, so...
Sweet.
We're at the top of the list of people who actually would be like on the show. Nice.
Yeah.
Well, let me just talk a little bit about kind of where I came from. I grew up in British Columbia doing all kinds of outdoorsy stuff, and have kind of been in and around health and fitness and exercise and nutrition and that whole mindset for as long as I can remember. I'm a physical therapist by profession. I have been doing that for 9 years. And, you know, along the way, learned a lot about nutrition and exercise personally, but sort of a professional interest too. I was a strength and conditioning coach for several years. And in my day-to-day practice talking to my rehab patients, the longer time went on, the more I found myself talking to them about things that were not necessarily physical therapy by its traditional definition. You know, I found them talking to them about managing inflammation via nutrition and stress management and sleep quality and a lot of these other kind of lifestyle factors. And the longer time went on, the less I was able to do just physical therapy. It sort of became this kind of multifactorial approach that started to get me in a little bit of hot water with my job, because they kind of said, well, you're not necessarily doing straight PT, which is what your job description is. But ultimately, you know, I came to realize that you can't really do some of these things without the other. And if you want to, you know, have optimal rehab results, you also have to kind of not just do the, you know, the manual therapy or the exercise or any of the modalities, but you also have to really set yourself up with optimal nutrition and other factors. So the whole nine is essentially a statement of these, you know, multiple factors that we can't really optimize our performance without addressing all of them. So that's kind of how that came about. And, you know, that was something that Melissa and I shared in terms of our big picture perspective. So here we are.
So what actually is the whole nine?
The list of nine.
Mm-hmm. You have it memorized?
We should, right? No, don't go to it. We're trying to cheat now by going to, but we're going to rattle it off the top of our head. It's not nine. It's not necessarily that we think there are nine like fitness factors. It's just when we are working with clients or working with our, you know, one-on-one consulting people, we look at a list of kind of nine health and fitness related factors to analyze what's going on and triage their priorities. So it's nutrition, it's training, it's sleep, it is active recovery and stress management, injury rehabilitation, and then a couple factors that you may not think of when you're kind of thinking about health and fitness goals, but it's everything from fun and play to personal growth and sort of personal development. And then finally, temperance. You know, all of those things, including training and nutrition, require temperance. It can be easy to go off the reservation on any one of those factors. So we kind of throw that in at the end because everything has to, of course, have a balance.
Does that add up to nine?
I hope so.
I think that's nine-ish. We're whole nine-ish.
The numbers are very loose around here, no matter what we talk about. So it sounds good to me.
Cool.
If Rob buys it, I mean, you know.
We're in. Well, I was trying to convince Andy that I had a 35-minute long kipping pull-up instructional video. I'm like, no, Andy, it's 20 or 30 minutes, and it was 6 minutes. So it just seemed very, very long because whenever I talk, just time drags on and people pray for early demise. So,
but I'm just a nice enough person that I went and checked exactly how long it is just to make sure we had the facts.
Yeah, well, and then he neenered me. So if that was, in fact, not nine topics, Andy will get back to you guys on that.
Okay, great. That's great. Maybe he can suggest a ninth one then if we've missed one.
Perfect.
I don't know what that would be. Maybe margaritas or something.
All right, so we got a different group of questions dedicated to the whole nine today, which is very exciting. This means that not only will Rob talk in short amounts today, Rob, but Dallas and Melissa will actually answer the questions, and you can add your 3 cents, but it can't be more than like 3 minutes.
Okay, I will keep it much less than that.
I'm just messing with you. So we got a first question from Mike. Super long question, so I'm kind of just going to read part one. We'll kind of talk about that in part two, and then I don't think we're going to read the background. This may actually be the record for the longest question we've ever received. And I just can't read that long because I'm not very articulate. So, first question from Mike. He wants to start by saying that he's from New Hampshire, like Miss Urban. So I am hopeful that my question will be seen as seeking clarity and not just an effort to have you restate the obvious. People from back east have a unique mastery of the obvious and no problem telling you how to live free or die, sometimes in very emphatic, descriptive, and creative terms. I digress. Ready for a stupid question?
I concur.
That is why they call it the Granite State. So.
That's right. So, first question, if I'm doing unweighed, unmeasured paleo, how much fat should I be eating? Seriously, I know it is unweighed and unmeasured, so asking how much is stupid, but I'm just looking for a guideline here regarding the fat formula for leading out from podcast 6 answer to Megan's question. The answer to Megan's question implies that there may be some body weight level where the formula dissipates. I refer to your reference to John Wellborn and his size playing some part in the formula, but I couldn't quite capture what you meant. In other words, should I short some of my fat as my caloric restriction effort?
Can we just take part one and part two together? Is that
yeah,
right?
We can do it. No, we cannot. This is performance art. We have rules. No, absolutely.
Roll on with the longest question ever.
Okay. We're only going to read half of it, but yes, here's question two. Not so stupid question. Timing to consume my fat. Assuming I'm calculating the fat formula for leaning out correctly, see below, and have 207 grams or 1,800 calories of fat, when can I eat them? More specifically, I've been eating three times a day, a pound of meat at two of my three meals, and my fat at meals is from olive oil for cooking, avocados, and fat from the meat source, which leaves me with a bunch of leftover fat. I basically want to eat some of my fat as a snack at 8 p.m. after the kids are in bed. I'm thinking 1 to 2 ounces of almonds, 1/4 cup coconut shavings, and maybe 1 to 1.5 ounces of Trader Joe's dark chocolate bar. My brain is saying that is a lot of energy to take in before bed at 10 p.m. My brain is also saying, add a hunk of protein every time I eat. I have no steeping in pseudoscience, so what do you think? Eat the fat at 8 p.m. okay? Eat the fat without protein okay? Should I skip the fat and go to bed a little hungry, or is it just too important?
Whoa. So, whoa. You know, we read the question through about 10 times and then kind of, in big picture, I think we can summarize this by saying, dear Mike, you are thinking too much. But we'll get into it. Maybe we'll get into a little bit more detail. Maybe that's a little too live free or die for West Coast radio.
Seriously.
So our thoughts in terms of a big picture are that, you know, the formulas that Rob has laid out, and maybe Rob, you can speak to this after, but the formulas are kind of an estimate in terms of just coming up with a good starting point. You know, it's like that guideline of 1 gram of protein per pound of body weight. That's a good place to start, but people are going to need either a little more or a little less or a lot less based on what their, you know, goals are, body composition, all that stuff. So, you know, that formula could be considered just a good starting point, but taking a look at just general kind of common sense factors, are you hungry? You know, if you're hungry all the time, then maybe you're not eating enough fat, but it seems like his hunger levels are, you know, pretty manageable. In terms of his performance, he says he's still, in some of the detail that you didn't read, he's still making gains in the gym. He's still losing body fat. He's, you know, working towards getting his workouts as RX. So those all seem to indicate that his nutrition is supporting his big picture health and fitness goals. So, you know, with that having been said, he may not need to try to jam extra fat in at the end of the night just because the formula tells him to. Furthermore, man, he's eating 2 or 3 times a day. And if he's getting over 200 grams of fat in total, or that's what he's working towards, that's just a ton of fat in each meal. He doesn't mention anything about snacking or anything in between meals, but it seems to me that it might be more effective or more efficient if he's finding him, he's real hungry at night before he goes to bed. He's thinking, maybe I should add more fat at bed. Well, maybe in general, he could just spread the fat around a little bit more instead of eating it in just 3 chunks, you know, take some out and eat fat either by itself as a snack throughout the day or with, if he wants to do it with a little bit of protein and a little bit of carbs, that all that protein in just 3 sittings too. I feel like my stomach hurts just thinking about that. So spreading that out may be a better solution as opposed to trying to just like jam more in late at night. And I know he didn't specifically ask about the kind of fat that he's eating, but because we from New Hampshire also like to be a little forward and a little direct, I may also suggest he vary his fat kind of sources a little bit. He's talking about getting his fat mostly from meat and then a little bit from, you know, some like coconut olive oil. But part of me is wondering if maybe he tries to get different forms of fat in throughout the day, if he might find that a little bit more satisfying just from a mental aspect. I can't imagine eating that much meat 2 or 3 times a day and just kind of calling that good in terms of fat consumption.
Or taking that many shots of olive oil.
Yeah.
I don't know. That sounds like heaven to me, but.
Dallas, what do you think?
You know, he asked a question really about, you know, is it okay to eat fat, you know, before he goes to bed? And I guess that's the question is, does, you know, is he really having to work that hard to get that much fat in? I mean, if he's trying to get in over 200 grams of fat, if, you know, it seems like he's getting adequate protein, he's keeping his carbs pretty low per the formula. I'm not necessarily convinced he needs 207 grams of fat, particularly if he's performing well and continuing to get, you know, to shed body fat. So I would say, yeah, he's overthinking it a little bit in the sense that if he's doing well, heading in a good direction, he may not need to cram all that extra fat in. There's also a point in there about using chocolate as a fat source before bed. And I don't know that that's maybe your optimal fat choice, but that's just me being nitpicky. But ultimately, I mean, I guess if you're, you know, if he's getting enough protein to support his muscle mass and his activity level, you know, enough carbs to keep his brain happy, and he's getting plenty of fat, which it seems like he is, he probably doesn't need to cram more calories in than he already is. That's kind of my take on that. So, you know, if he feels like he needs more calories total and he's getting adequate protein and carb intake elsewhere and he wants a few more calories in, I'm fine with fat right before bed. But I would say in general, you know, an hour or two before bed just gives his body a chance to actually like rest and not digest all night too. So, Rob, you have anything to add on that?
Yeah, you know, anytime I throw out some sort of a quantifier, I usually end up deeply regretting it because it's almost inevitably more exceptions than rule, and people end up really geeking out on the finer points. Like, what I've found is folks who are really focused on leaning out, and this is like straight out of like Charles Poliquin's playbook, Mauro Di Pasquale, like, they just basically have people free protein and veggies and really go minimal fat addition to your meal plan. You'll have great satiety because the protein ends up releasing leptin, neuropeptide YYY. It shuts off any sense of hunger. So you're just not hungry. You feel great. You're satisfied. You're caloric restricted despite despite the fact that you're caloric restricted, you're really not all that hungry. And if the main focus here, again, usually when I tackle these, I try to figure out, okay, what's your primary goal here? It sounds like he's primarily trying to lean out. So we'll focus on that. He's keeping an eye on his performance, which is good. Sometimes when you're leaning out, some elements, your performance may dip, particularly like top end strength. So that's just kind of some of the give and take you need to keep in mind with that. Really, I'm not off put by like the 3-meal-a-day kind of gig, just from the simplicity standpoint and all that. But again, like you guys pointed out, he doesn't necessarily need to cram arbitrary amounts of food down the pie hole if he's otherwise satisfied and he's otherwise making gains. And then that one thought about before bed, if the primary goal is fat loss, you get your largest pulsatile release of growth hormone about 1 hour into sleep, but it is pretty well shut off if you have any amount of elevated circulating free fatty acids or glucose. And so eating before bed is going to kind of shut off one of his primary mechanisms of fat loss and regeneration, recovery, all that sort of jive. So I wouldn't really be a fan of throwing the fat down immediately before bed unless he was actually on a mass gain program.
Yep.
Makes sense.
And that was a hell of a question, too. Everybody's going to love reading the show notes.
Yeah, it was a long one.
It's the longest ever, but everyone should be on a mass gain program, Rob. That's what we've learned this week.
It's true. It's true.
I've been on a mass gain program since this morning.
Dallas, I would love to see how much you would have to eat to gain 10 pounds, brother.
Oh, dude, it's so much work.
You know, I just stop working out and I get fat. It's awesome.
We all have our battles, I guess.
That was the direction I went.
All right, so now I got a question from Jason. It says, what's the current science on using cinnamon to increase insulin sensitivity? I've seen numerous references to its efficacy, but I'm not clear if that's really been established. And if so, what dosages should we be using? Does the origin freshness of the cinnamon matter, i.e. what are all the variables? I already eat low-carb paleo with some dairy, but if this can help, seems like an easy win. Thanks.
I love questions like this. I like questions like this because basically the response is, and I would, you know, kind of, I'm going to temper it a little, but it's like, if you're still eating some dairy, dude, maybe don't really worry about the cinnamon just yet and focus on getting that out of your diet first. You know, in terms of bang for your buck with insulin sensitivity and inflammation and everything from body composition to, you know, performance goals and just general, like, how you feel, taking the dairy out is going to do so much more for all of those factors than, you know, sprinkling a little bit of cinnamon on your coffee. So it's sort of like cart before the horse in my book. if all of those other factors are in line and you've, you know, got all those foods out of your diet and you're eating clean and training smart and recovering well and, you know, so your sleep is in line and you want to, you know, throw some cinnamon in, then I guess it kind of makes sense. But until that stuff is figured out, I'm sort of like, you kind of can't worry about the small details before you get the big picture stuff solid.
But what if his dairy is only some heavy cream in his coffee in the morning? Or
you are a nitpicker, aren't you?
Or what if he's bulking and, you know, he wants to get 70s big?
Oh.
Oh, man, you should not get me started on that.
Imagine if you guys had Andy in your gym, which I do.
Imagine the questions you would get asked during trainer meetings.
Well, the good news is I would only have to run that gym for, like, another, like, week or something because I would either quit or make Andy go away.
See, I feel bad, though. I made Andy move here from, like, Arizona, so.
Yeah. You should have done your research more thoroughly.
No, and you know what? You make some good points. If his dairy, I don't want Jason to come back and say, well, my only dairy is, you know, organic heavy cream from grass-fed cows in my coffee, you know, because then I suppose maybe the same concerns wouldn't all apply, which is why we did a little homework and a little research onto cinnamon and the effects that dosages of cinnamon may have on everything from insulin sensitivity to insulin signaling to glucose control, and even some studies that reference that cinnamon can do good things for triglyceride levels, lowering triglycerides. So this is sort of the science-y area that maybe Rob is better suited to answer, but we did come across a whole bunch of studies, both on diabetics and on kind of general populations, that suggest that cinnamon, even in lower amounts used pretty consistently, can do good things for that. So
I think the dosages they used were between 1 and 6 grams a day. So that's, you know, a quarter of a teaspoon to a little over a teaspoon, something like that. So it's not gigantic amounts. It's, sometimes you read studies that, you know, they tell you at such and such a dosage, it works great, but it's a dosage that you couldn't really use in your diet. So at least these are kind of reasonable doses. Rob, you want to speak to the effects of cinnamon?
It's a insulin secretagogue, so it works similarly to insulin. It appears to work directly on the insulin receptor sites. And it's pretty intriguing in that it seems to lower overall insulin levels while lowering blood glucose levels, but not to a degree that it induces hypoglycemia. And it seems to improve lipid metabolism. So that's where we see a lowering in triglycerides, a normalizing in blood glucose levels, and all of it seems to be happening at the insulin receptor site. And we don't see a rebound effect in which discontinuing cinnamon will see insulin resistance. We don't see that. So it seems to be a pretty legit item. The thing that's intriguing to me is we do not see a really strong decrease in A1C, so the glycated hemoglobin. Most of the stuff that I've looked at, you don't really see much of a change in the glycated hemoglobin, even with the diabetic folks, which is really intriguing to me. It's a little bit counterintuitive, but I think, you know, a nice place to drop in a little bit of cinnamon would be if folks are doing some post-workout carbs or even just general, like, post-workout insulin sensitivity, even a low-carb kind of scenario. You could put in, like Dallas said, a quarter to a teaspoon, I think, would be plenty for a dose of cinnamon into your meal and probably get some enhanced insulin sensitivity, all that. Out of that, one thing to keep in mind, cinnamon does have some water-soluble toxins in it. And so you do not want to go bananas on it. About a 1 to 4 gram, 1 to 5 gram dose is plenty. The toxin in it is not that big a deal, but you can't overdo it. It's at much lower dosage levels than what you get the insulin sensitizing effect. So your therapeutic dose is comparatively low, and just stick with that. More is definitely not a better scenario on this.
Plus, cinnamon makes everything taste better, like coconut.
It does taste pretty damn yummy.
Yes.
You
can really put it on anything in my house.
Yeah, I do like a little cinnamon in my coffee.
I put it on my ground beef. I don't know what you're talking about.
You know, a little cinnamon with some allspice and a dash of curry for breakfast cooking is pretty damn good.
Mm-hmm. Nice. I like it. Cool. Good question. Melissa, don't be so mean next time.
I know. Sorry.
So now we got a question from Captain Tom related to artificial sweeteners. Can we say who Captain Tom is?
Yeah, you better. He's going to call me and be really mad.
So this is Melissa's dad in the Florida Keys. Where exactly in the Florida Keys does he live?
He's in Cujo Key. He's at like mile marker 23. He just keeps moving further and further south.
That's right. A good plan.
Yeah.
So his question is, what is your take on stevia as a limited? Limited is capitalized and should be bolded replacement for sugar. I know about the sweet slippery slope and preserving pre-Whole 30 sweet tooth habits, but there are some recipes that simply need a touch of sweetening in the flavor profile to fully develop their full potential. Wow. Stevia seems to be a viable replacement since it is plant-based, available without additives or chemical processing, has zero calories and carbs, and claims not to affect blood sugar levels. Your thoughts?
So I just have to give a little plug to my dad here. We did actually a blog post on his birthday. My dad had just quit smoking. He was a smoker for about 50 years, and he and his wife quit. They have been smoke-free for somewhere in the neighborhood of like 3 or 4 months now, which is awesome, and he's been doing so well with that. But that has sort of led him to making other changes in his life. So we had been talking just about every morning on my way to work, and he started asking me questions about diet and training, and you know, he started swapping out his potatoes for vegetables and started kind of cutting back on his butter and salt, and he's, you know, doing some walking and some push-ups and squats, and you know, so he's really started to think a lot more about some of his habits and some of his behaviors, you know, post-smoking, because his kind of goal is like he's a fisherman. He wants to be able to fish well into, you know, his later years and be able to reel the big ones in. So I think it's pretty awesome that he's been sending us so many questions and, you know, requests. And I was really happy to be able to answer one of his questions here on the podcast. So
very cool.
Very cool.
I'll go ahead and take the direct answer. I guess the central concept that we presented at our workshops is sort of the concept of, you know, does food make you healthier or less healthy? So we can kind of, you know, generally lump most foods into a category that either makes you healthier or less healthy. And sugar and the, you know, non-nutritive sweeteners tend to pretty easily be lumped into that, you know, make you less healthy category. So whether the stevia, you know, whether it provokes an insulin response, whether it contains calories, you know, I almost see that as partly a moot point, in the sense that if we're trying to really, you know, emphasize food that is like really nutrient dense, in general, we want to kind of steer away from stuff that doesn't make us healthier. You know, there's been some research that shows that, you know, that sugar substitutes, they're really sweet flavors, you know, cause an insulin response. I know, Rob, you've talked about this in the past. And then kind of the other point that we talk about, you know, with our consulting clients and in our workshops is, you know, the concept that, you know, we don't need to rely on these really, really big time, flavors of really salty, really sweet, really spicy. That there's a lot more like subtle and enjoyable flavors in real healthy fresh food, and that if the more we can steer away from those kind of, you know, those really big flavors, those super salty, super sweet, and really like spicy, the more we can learn to appreciate kind of the subtleties of you know, meat and vegetables and fruit and nuts and all the things that we tell people to eat. So that's kind of the premise that we come at it from.
I did a couple studies. I did research a couple studies, and we talk about this in general, quoting, you know, when your body just tastes something sweet, it doesn't necessarily know the difference between an artificial sweetener and the real thing. So just the ingestion of artificial sweeteners, including stevia, based on some of the studies that I've read, can provoke an insulin response. And one of the studies, that was a Danish study, I think, it talked about the fact that intense sweeteners have a GI around zero, but insulin can be stimulated by the byproducts of the sweetener during digestion. And stevia was one of those mentioned, that it can have an impact on insulin. So you know, you're not necessarily doing yourself any favors from an insulin perspective if you are swapping out sugars for the artificial sweeteners. In turn, you know, obviously I'm going to have a chat with my dad about what recipes he thinks absolutely need a touch of sweetening flavor, because I pushed back on this one, and we're actually going to go down and visit him in a couple weeks, so we'll chat about this. But, you know, we don't really say that stevia would be a good choice. We just say that it would be less bad, considering it's plant-based and available without additives or chemical processing. You know, if you have to use one of those, we'd say something like stevia or pure organic honey or maple syrup would be a less bad option. But for all the reasons Dallas talked about, you know, clearly not ideal. And to break those habits and cravings and patterns, you really want to stay away from all of that stuff, in our opinion.
Yeah, I would second that. Like, the thing that I've observed is the folks who really kind of dig in their heels on, like, wanting to use some stevia, wanting to use some artificial sweeteners, or, you know, just generally keeping some sweeteners in the mix more often than not, they just don't succeed. Just the bottom line, they keep their palate pretty well wired up for, like what Dallas was saying, the intense flavors, and then it just kind of rolls one thing into the other. It's kind of the gateway drug. And mentioning gateway drugs, this is where, like, from my background in, like, biochemistry, toxicology, like, the fact it comes from a plant, it, making it somehow more benign than anything else is kind of hilarious. But it's literally some of the most toxic stuff known is plant or microbially derived, and it's not stuff that we're making at all. Biology's had a long time to figure out how to make some amazingly toxic stuff. So, and that's not to say that stevia is, but just simply ascribing some sort of, like, benefit because it's, quote, natural is a little bit misplaced for me. But folks love to do that. That's totally cool. I had one other really snarky thought, but I'll keep that to myself.
I thought you were going to use your uranium or whatever.
Yeah, it's the whole deal. You know, plutonium is natural, but it's not necessarily healthy for you. So,
yeah, that's probably fair.
Yeah.
Hopefully your dad still likes us.
And, you know, just as an aside, even within that, and this is totally my own opinion on this, but, like, folks start getting to some degree a sense that, like, if they're going to use a sweetener, that, like, maple syrup or honey or sucanat or something is better because it's got minerals in it or something. And if you're looking to your sweeteners as a source of minerals, we've got a problem. Like, we have a serious problem. If you're going to make some gluten-free pancakes or gluten-free bread, or you're going to kick your heels up, just kick your heels up. You know, it's like, get some CNH pure cane sugar and do it up. But just keep that in the context of what you're up to. I think people will lull themselves into this sense of complacency, or, like, well, I'm not really being that bad because I'm using, like, honey, you know, a giant glopping tablespoon of it in my tea each morning. And it's like, no, it's still sugar. And if you're still battling with, like, weight loss problems and recidivism going into sweetened foods, then you're going to have to address that if you want to succeed.
Yeah.
So good on Captain Tom, man. It sounds like he's completely done a revamp. That's awesome.
He's working on it. I don't really care, Andy, if he still likes you guys. I just care if he still likes us, because we really want to go fishing and snorkeling when we visit him in a couple weeks. So,
well, I think that was the point I was trying to make, you know.
Yes.
If I come across Captain Tom in my time, you know, I'm sure we'll have a nice chat. But otherwise, I think it's better that, you know, you get along. You guys can still play nice. All right, good. Next, we got a friend from a question from our friend Catherine. Catherine is 31-year-old female, 5'7", 135, CrossFits 3 times a week, and 18 out of 20 meals are completely paleo. I've been eating this way for over a year and have lost 30 pounds, experienced increased energy, and I'm reaching fitness levels I never knew I was capable of. However, every 2 months or so, I experience an extremely distended abdomen. I generally tend towards a sensitivity to bloating in that I have a flat stomach in the morning and a rounded belly in the evening, even on a completely paleo diet. However, it can get extreme and my entire abdomen wall can become hard and distended. It usually lasts about 1 to 3 weeks. The first time this happened, I was participating in an 8-week paleo challenge and eating squeaky clean. I cut out the veggies that tended to cause gas, cabbage, broccoli, cauliflower. I also discontinued the use of birth control pills and switched my fat sources to be based in coconut and avocado instead of nut butters. Within a week of these changes, the bloating subsided. However, 2 months later, it has returned with a vengeance and has been lasting for about 2 weeks now. increased water, no salt, and the previous changes I mentioned are not helping. I also take fish oil, vitamin D, probiotics, and Juice Plus. The majority of the research I find on the internet points to gassy foods, swallowing too much air, and various diseases like celiac disease. I have a fairly consistent schedule and get 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night. Is there something that I am not considering that I need to adjust? Any and all advice would be much appreciated, as it is very uncomfortable and certainly not flattering. And then she also attached a couple of pictures, which we won't post on the internet.
But she is like completely jacked in the one photo, and then the other photo, she's got a distended belly.
Mm-hmm. I'll jump in on that. You know, I think the thing that struck me right off was that, you know, the first time she really noticed that was, you know, kind of when she first went squeaky clean paleo for a challenge. And it was kind of the first couple of weeks. And I think, Rob, you've talked about the kind of the adaptive process that takes place as people kind of change their diets in a pretty significant way. But I know you can have some kind of decreased intestinal motility when you take out some really inflammatory stuff out of your diet, even if it's relatively small amounts, and you go to kind of really, really clean. Likely also she's probably bumping up her intake of fiber-rich veggies just in an attempt to be, you know, more aware of her dietary choices during the paleo challenge. So, the kind of the combination of, you know, some increased, you know, some increased roughage and increased fiber content from her veggies, and then perhaps just the sort of this adaptive process where there's not as much of a mucus secretion in the GI tract to kind of smooth things along, perhaps just cause a little bit of retention until things kind of adjust. She talked about gas. I'm not necessarily sure. I don't necessarily suspect that gas is a real issue with that. That's a real cause of that. She did mention, I don't think I have celiac. You know, that's one of those things that, there's nothing really to point to that. We did do a little bit of research about the content of one of the things that she mentioned that she takes, the Juice Plus. I can have Melissa speak to that, but that would be my kind of where I would lean towards is, just sort of an adaptive process. She said it comes around again, you know, it's happened more than once, a couple months later. It's been happening for a couple weeks. So I don't know if she's made any more recent changes kind of second time around like she did the first time when she went squeaky clean paleo, but that would be kind of what I would lean towards, my hunch off the bat.
Yeah, it's interesting, like the problem-solving aspect of this, and I almost wish, and if she isn't doing this already, I almost wish we had kind of like a food log and a symptoms log, you know, with something like this that seems really like a mystery. It's very helpful to keep track in terms of what you're eating and when these effects are coming around. You may be able to recognize some correlations that sort of you missed if you're writing them down. But, you know, we took a good hard look at all of the stuff that she was eating and what she was omitting and what she was adding, and then did some research onto this Juice Plus stuff. So Juice Plus, it turns out, and I actually have it pulled up. I had never heard of that supplement before, but it's a supplement in pill form that is supposed to provide, you would imagine, a whole bunch of vegetables and grain, vegetables and fruits. But when you look at the website, the information there says 17 fruits, vegetables, and grains. So I took a look at the ingredients, and this stuff has like oat bran and rice bran in it. If you did some research into oat bran and rice bran, and like in rice bran, for example, the anti-nutrition factors in the rice grain are concentrated in the bran. So that's where the, you know, phytates and lectins are. So if she's taking these pills on a regular basis, even if her diet was 100% squeaky clean paleo, the point is if she's got some serious, issues with gluten or other types of, you know, grain-related lectin inflammation kick in, you don't need a lot of exposure to actually keep that inflammatory process kicking. So Dallas, I think, has some studies referenced in terms of like how little you need to keep that process going.
Yeah, it was reading about they were using gliadin and gluten in mice to see what, you know, how much, what the dose response was you know, and what the how much they would have to give these mice to create an inflammatory process in their bodies. And they were looking talking about dosages that were like 50 micrograms. You know, so you extrapolate that out to the size of a 200-pound human, and you're only talking about like a hundredth of a gram. It doesn't require a really large amount to provoke a response in people, especially if they are particularly sensitive, which Catherine might be. So
the other piece of it too, she said 18 of her 20 males are completely paleo, but what that means is that like every fifth day or so, or depending on kind of what she's doing in terms of her like cheats or treats, she's got some stuff in there that again could be kicking up that that inflammation and that irritation, because not only do you only need a tiny amount of those particular foods if you're extremely sensitive to kick that up, you really only need one exposure every, I think, 10 days is some of the, you know, some of the studies that we've read says one exposure every 10 days can keep that going. So I guess what I might recommend for Catherine is keeping a food log, not necessarily for the purpose of weighing and measuring, but keeping a food log in terms of what you're eating, and go 100% squeaky clean, all grains, all dairy, all legumes, all sugars and processed foods, nix in the juice plus for sure. And if you want to go so far as even maybe removing nuts, I know sometimes that can be kind of a factor, and do that for like a solid 30 days or 45 days and kind of keep track and see how the symptoms are going, see if that kind of helps or if that sort of helps things subside. It may just be that she's got a sensitivity and she just keeps that going with the little bit of treats and the little bit of stuff that she's getting in her supplements. So that was kind of our thought. Rob, you got any additional?
No, that sounds spot on. And the irony with this is that as you clean all that stuff up, the gut lining actually gets more healthy between the exposures. And so then the subsequent response appears to be even worse. Like you hurt worse, you have more bloating, you have more gas. When you get that exposure and the gut lining is irritated, even fruits become problematic because you can't really process fructose properly. So no, I think you guys are spot on. That sounds legit to me.
Good. So yeah, I'd be interested to kind of hear some follow up from her, because this was a really interesting, like kind of a mystery. We like mysteries. We're problem solvers, you know.
Yeah, I've been saying for years, like, I'm a problem solver. That's like what I do for a job, and that's kind of what has flowed into our, you know, practice the whole nine. So we're problem solvers. We like that.
And you're damn good at it too.
Wow.
Thanks.
I need a NorCal margarita.
Seriously, it's 1 p.m. our time, so it's time to drink.
It's already happy hour here.
Yep.
For sure. All right, good. Next, we got a question from George. George says, loves the podcast and blogs. I know people have asked before about how things like fish oil are too expensive, and the basic answer is to rearrange your priorities to accommodate your health. I've done this as much as I can at college, but I still truly have no funds left over to buy any fish oil. Is there any other way I can speed up the repair of my omega-6, omega-3 imbalance? That is all I need out of the fish oil. Thanks a lot.
Cool. Yeah, I liked this question. I like this question because...
Because you're going to be nicer than Rob would? Is that...
well, see. I don't know.
It's also not a page and a half long.
Yeah. No, I liked it because I do get that there are, you know, if it were super easy to be able to eat, you know, 100% perfectly all the time, everyone would do it. But there are some constraints, and I guess considering Dallas and I both just recently quit our jobs, and I guess I could have a little bit of sympathy or empathy for his plea for something that's a little on the cheaper end. So, I guess some of the things we're thinking about, fish oil being expensive, and we know that it is. There was something posted on your blog not too long ago. You guys addressed fish oil sort of matrix that talks about bang for the buck in terms of price per dosage of EPA and DHA. So that's a good place to start. You know, if you're going to purchase it, you want to make sure you're getting the most value for your dollar at the highest quality. But that aside, some of the things that we could think about in terms of managing And I'm not even going to talk about necessarily just managing omega-6 to omega-3 ratio, but in terms of just generally managing inflammation, because that's really the point of the ratio balance in the fish oil, is to just manage general systemic inflammation. So a couple things that we think that George could do would be, in general, to reduce his nut consumption as a primary fat source. So if he's eating a lot of nuts, maybe pulling those back and adding in more hazelnut and macadamia. Those are tend to be higher in monounsaturated fats, so that might pull back the general amount of omega-6s he's getting. And if you sub that out for things like coconut milk, coconut oil, avocado, olives, olive oil, those also are going to do a little bit for pulling back that N6 number and ramping up different types of fat. It would be great for us to say that you should go out and get, you know, grass-fed ground beef, because that's got a lot of good omega-3s, but clearly that's, if cost is a factor with fish oil, that's going to be a factor for meat as well. So, you know, if you can't do the grass-fed stuff, then buying the highest quality and the leanest cuts of meat are going to help in terms of, you know, poor quality meat equals poor quality fat. So pulling that back would help. And then I assume that there are some eggs in George's diet. Eggs are a pretty inexpensive source of protein, and eggs are also one of the easiest things to buy fresh and local and organic. And again, if you're shaking the hand of the farmer and you're looking at the chickens outside, you know, pecking the ground, eating seeds and bugs, the fat profile, the omega-3s in those eggs are going to be higher as well, and those will be of higher quality. So if you're already eating eggs, swapping them out for higher quality eggs might help. Dallas, do you have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I mean, he made the point, you know, that he was really wanting to, you know, use fish oil as a way to kind of manage his inflammation. You know, adding more omega-3s to improve your omega-6 to omega-3 ratio is not necessarily the only way to do it. You know, Melissa talked about changing, you know, fat sources to kind of manage that a little better, but you know, there are other pieces that other things that play into inflammation. Certainly, managing insulin levels in general, you know, play right into managing systemic inflammation. So, if he's looking to manage his inflammation via fish oil, I just want to make sure he's not missing the point that you know, managing insulin levels via diet, you know, plays right into that too. And that, you know, we talk a lot about that in our workshops of making food choices that really really lead down the road of managing inflammation. And part of that also is, you know, Dr. Cordain talks about, you know, acid-base balance and getting a good vegetable and fruit intake to kind of mitigate the really concentrated acidifying effects of meat, fish, eggs, nuts. So making sure he's getting some good vegetable intake in there, kind of end up in a nice balanced, maybe even slightly alkaline state, is going to help to manage his inflammation too. So there's kind of more to it than just the fish oil.
I dig it. And, you know, just in the price point, the cheaper meats are typically the leaner meats. So like pork loin, London broil, all that sort of stuff. So it helps on the price point. And then like Matt Lalonde has really been pinning my ears back on the point that it's not just, we can't just mega dose fish oil and undo omega-6 ingestion. Like, we really need to nip in the bud omega-6 ingestion right from the get-go if we really want to mitigate the inflammation. So I mean, all of the, it's kind of funny, people really took Cordain to task years ago when he recommended eating leaner cuts of meat. But the reason why I was recommending leaner cuts of meat were to establish a favorable omega-3, omega-6 ratio right up front. And if you look at his book from the Journal of the American Nutraceutical Society, one of, you know, just one of those hallmark papers where he looks at building a Paleolithic diet using contemporary foods, he's just getting leaner cuts of meat. He eats a little bit of wild salmon here and there. Like you guys mentioned, the nuts that are heavier and short chain omega-3s, although not ideal, it's better than nothing. But where that reconstructed diet finished out was net alkalinizing, high protein, moderate fat, and an end omega-3 omega-6 ratio of about 1 omega-3 for every 1.5 omega-6, which is perfect. It's just spot on.
Well said. All right.
Cool.
Look how nice you are today, Rob. I feel like the whole nine has really calmed you down.
They bring balance to the force.
Nice. We're soothing.
That is the first time that has ever been said about me.
Well, never mind. Just going to make a joke at Rob's expense. We'll let it slide.
Do it.
No, we're good. We're good, Rob.
Just remember, your cup at the gym is left unattended sometimes. That's all all I'm going to say.
Next question, fresh versus frozen vegetables from John Michael. John says, he recently read where frozen veggies and fruits are considered better than fresh. Their reasons, fresh starts losing their nutritional value the instant they are picked, and if left sitting in a grocery store or on a train heading for Timbuktu, they'll lose a great deal of nutritional value. Whereas frozen lose some, but once frozen retain their nutritional values. For those of us who don't have a self-sustaining garden in our backyards, I'd like to hear Whole Nine address this topic. Thank you, John Michael.
Cool. Yeah, this question came in actually directly to us through one of our kind of long-term readers. So, and it's a good question because we get this at a lot of our workshops, and there's a balance. You know, there's this like kind of balance between, you know, if you have a hard time getting your vegetables in, or you don't like a lot of vegetables, then you want to steer towards the fresh stuff. The fresh vegetables are going to taste better. They're going to have, you know, they're going to be more palatable. They're going to be more appealing. So that's sort of one piece of the puzzle. If you can't get to the grocery store every 3 days to buy fresh produce because that stuff goes bad pretty fast, then, you know, frozen vegetables might have to be a little bit more of a go-to. But you do lose a little bit of nutrition in the blanching process before you freeze the fruits and vegetables, and long-term storage of them as well will also degrade some nutrients, vitamin C for one in particular. So there's sort of a trade-off between, you know, kind of what your lifestyle factors require and what your tastes require. And really a lot of it also kind of depends on the season. So we sort of came up with some guidelines, like a good, better, best in terms of thinking about your fruit and vegetable choices. Dallas will hit those.
Yeah, I'm gonna say best first. So this is kind of your optimal. You know, we talk a lot about kind of buying locally, not just to, you know, support your local economy, but also just because, you know, you're not, you know, your food isn't being shipped all over the place, and all of the cost and you know, general inefficiency that goes with that. So kind of our best case is, you know, buy locally, organically, and seasonally. You know, we really like people to get involved in the food chain. So, you know, shake the hand of the farmer, you know, go to the farmer's market, you know, hunt some people down who actually like grow some of the food you eat in your local area, and make choices that lean towards those, you know, really high quality local choices. You know, participate in a CSA, you know, kind of during the spring, summer, fall, you can really get some, you know, great, you know, fresh local food. And if you have to, you know, buy a share and split it with somebody, that's a great way to go. That's kind of your best bet. I guess I'd say your next best bet, or better, I guess, is, you know, buying your produce as you know, as locally as you can. You know, like at a local, like health food store, who connects with local farmers or ships stuff in from not too far away. You know, I guess what we're acknowledging here is that you don't have to necessarily eat exclusively seasonally, but if you're looking to really optimize the nutrient content of your food, you've got to get it, you know, earlier on before it has been, you know, picked off the plant, you know, for, you know, literally weeks at a time. Your good choice, I guess, your acceptable choice, is just going to pay attention to where your fruits and vegetables are coming from, you know, when you're buying them. If you're, you know, going to the Whole Foods and buying green grapes in February, you know, they're probably coming from Chile. You know, so I think that's really what John Michael was getting at was, you know, ultimately if something's being shipped that far, it's bound to lose some of its nutritive content in that shipping process. Not to mention the fact that it was picked well before it's actually ripe. Mm-hmm. So a lot of those nutrients really haven't totally ripened, just simply because it was picked early. That's sort of our good, better, best recommendations on that.
I like Bob, it. Anything you want to add?
No, I think just one of the benefits of like the frozen veggie deal, which we actually do quite a bit of, is it's just convenient. You get home, you're tired, you're hungry. I'll throw some, you know, coconut oil in a pan, some seasoning, start browning some meat, throw a bag of veggies on it, put a lid on the whole thing, put the timer for 10 minutes, and then, you know, you have a pretty good meal within about 10 to 15 minutes. I didn't have to cut it up. It's easy to deal with, and the nutrient content is still, you know, pretty darn solid, all things considered, but it's really, really convenient.
Mm-hmm. I guess that's the other thing that we kind of, it can, when you're, if you're at that point where your vegetable intake is really good and your overall diet is really dialed in and you want to start thinking about fruit quality or eating seasonally or, you know, scoping out the local farmers market or CSA, that's a great choice. For a lot of people who are just kind of getting started on this paleo thing or a Whole 30 thing, and they're just trying to transition away from their breads and cereals and into the vegetables, I don't care where your vegetables are coming from at that point, in terms of if you, you know, can only eat frozen vegetables, or if you like green beans and carrots, despite the fact that green beans are not technically paleo, like, we're good with that. You know, get them in wherever you can, and at some point down the line, you can go ahead and, if you've got capacity, focus on things like quality or locally or seasonally. But in the beginning, if this is, you know, kind of your first foray into this style of eating, just get the vegetables and fruits in where you can.
Totally.
All right. Good. Next, we got a question from Tim. The last question. We are making excellent time today.
Yay.
Yeah. Says, Aloha, Whole Nine. I've enjoyed reading, lurking on your blogs for quite a while. Thank you for the 30-day challenge. Changed my life. I'm still taking the slow and caring road to help my wife, a vegetarian of 17 years, back from autoimmune hell. But the reason for my email is I just had another manager at my work that I hadn't seen in some time stop by my office to intro her new supervisor. After the brief intro, she blurts out, my gosh, Tim, what happened to you? Now, I would never consider myself fat, but 2 years ago, I was 195 pounds and reasonably fit. Now, after going paleo, I am a lean 169 pounds. After a brief pause, I tell her and the new supervisor that I've always eaten pretty clean. However, I just cut out grains, legumes, and dairy. They just stare at me for a while and then ask, what do you eat? Sounds like I'm talking to my mom. I go into the lean meats, good fats, lots of vegetables, nuts, seeds, and fruit. I did my best Rob Wolf impression and went into the whole grain, have anti-nutrients, etc. After further small talk, they leave. Not sure I made the impression that I was going for.
They anyway. Will never come back.
Anyway, sorry for the rambling email. My question is, what is your new elevator pitch when people ask you what you're doing and how do you eat? Mahalo for any response. I always enjoy your spin on all things nutrition. Thanks.
Cool. We liked this question a lot. And the idea for the question came from an old blog post that on the Urban Gets Diesel site, where we did basically a CrossFit elevator pitch. You know, when people asked us, what, you know, we owned an affiliate and people said, what is CrossFit? You need to be able to come up with a pretty concise and clear way to explain that without scaring people off or making them, you know, kind of run for the hills or boring them to tears, because it takes you 80 minutes to explain a pretty simple concept. So that's sort of where his request is coming from. And we loved the idea of coming up with an elevator pitch for how we eat the way we eat, because people ask us all the time at our workshops. They ask us all the time, like, how do I explain this to my friends? How do I explain this to my family? And so, you know, we're going to tackle this on our website the week that this comes out. So maybe, Andy, that's something that you guys can link to. So we're going to do a little bit more work in terms of the actual wording. But, we came up with an elevator pitch, and we'll share it in a second. I think one of the things that we thought about in terms of when people ask how you eat, almost universally out of the gate, the first thing people say is, I don't eat grains, I don't eat dairy, I don't eat beans, I don't eat sugar, I don't eat processed foods. And when you come out of the gate with this whole big list of don'ts, like, I don't eat these things, and 99 times out of 100, those are all things that the person you are talking to still has in their diet, it immediately puts people on the defensive. You know, it'd be like saying, well, I don't drive to work every day. And it can come off with that kind of attitude where immediately the person feels almost bad because they have this idea that you're judging what they're doing based on what you've just told them. If you turn it around and phrase it the other way, so instead of saying like, well, I don't drive my car to work, you say like, I walk to work, that then tends to prompt more of a dialogue or an open discussion. So people would say, oh, like, well, what do you do? Do you walk? How long does it take you? What do you do when it rains? And it opens conversation. And I feel like that's the approach that we want to take in terms of how we eat the way that we eat. So, when we frame this, we really want to frame it in terms of the choices that we're making and why we're making these choices and what they are doing for us personally in terms of how we look and how we feel and what our performance in the gym looks like. And so it's I think leads to a little bit more of an open discussion if you frame it in terms of the positive choices that you're making, as opposed to just, I don't eat grains or dairy. Tell us, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, we say in our workshops too that I really feel strongly that food should be like a really positive, like social, cultural experience. And most of the time when people ask you direct questions about, you know, what you eat, it's usually like when you're eating something. So that's kind of not the time to, just kind of take it on and say, well, you know, this is what's wrong with what you're currently eating. We really try to keep it framed in a positive attitude, and then say like, okay, you know, like, I guess if people say like, hey, like, you know, why don't you eat grains, or why did you not list grains as one of the things that you would normally eat? Then, the onus is on you to kind of defend your perspective and justify it. Whereas if you just kind of, I think, focus on, the good, healthy, enjoyable food that you do eat, I think it's a lot less likely to really get people fired up and defensive. You can really get people super defensive just by like eating what you eat, and that's it. Like at my old job, it was like a circus when I pulled my lunch, just eating my food. That's it. You know, but that was enough to kind of get people, asking questions. Which is good, but you kind of have to be careful in that context, especially of how you answer those questions.
Yeah. So, we actually drafted an elevator pitch. Like, we drafted the way that we would answer this question. And I don't know if you want to, do you want to hear it on the air? Do you want us to write it up? What do you want to do?
Are you kidding? Of course we want to hear it on the air. You guys are dragging this out. It's like a three-part series here. Lay it on us.
Nice. All right. So this would be our elevator pitch, right? So, you know, somebody at work comes up and says like, how do you eat, or what are you eating? The concept is, you know, I eat real food, fresh, natural food that your great grandmother would recognize, like meat and vegetables and fruit and nuts. I choose foods that are nutrient dense with lots of naturally occurring vitamins and minerals, instead of foods that are calorie dense but don't include nearly as much nutrition. And food quality is important to me, so I'm really careful about where my meat comes from. I try to buy produce locally and organically as often as possible. And we pay attention to food quality. It's not a low-calorie diet. I eat as much as I need to maintain strength, energy, and healthy weight. In fact, my diet's probably much higher in fat than you would imagine. Fat isn't the enemy. It's a really good energy source, but I make sure to get good fat from high-quality foods like avocado, coconut, nuts, and grass-fed beef. I also eat fewer carbohydrates than I used to. I'm not purposefully making it a low-carb thing, but since I'm eating vegetables and fruits instead of bread, cereals, and beans, it just kind of happens to work out that way. Eating like this is good for maintaining a healthy metabolism, managing insulin levels, and reducing inflammation within the body. It's been doing really great things for my energy levels, body composition, and performance in the gym. It also helps minimize my risk for a whole host of lifestyle diseases and conditions like diabetes, heart attack, and stroke.
And then, you know, usually this is the point where we would kind of jump in and say, like, this is the specific, tangible evidence. Me personally, this is like all the great stuff that happened to me when I did this. So, you know, whether that is you were previously having a lot of trouble with leaning out and you dropped, you know, 5 or 10 pounds and your performance went a lot better. Sometimes it means, you know, your sleep quality is better. Your skin cleared up. You had a lot easier trouble or a lot easier time managing your stress. We had a friend of ours say that like the quality of her relationship with her husband decreased after she ate some really rotten food. Yeah. I don't know quite how that works, but she like observed that. So this is kind of where we would basically throw in like a little kind of a personal testimonial. Like, this is what eating this way has done for me personally. And that's pretty hard to argue with. You know, you can cite all kinds of scientific studies that prove or disprove anything you want, basically. But if you say this is the positive effect that eating this way has had on my life, it's kind of bomb-proof evidence.
Yeah. Our new on-ramp program where we introduce people to the whole NorCal strength and conditioning scene, and it's a beginner program. It's got 12, you know, a month-long, 12-visit kind of gig. And before folks even show up, we send them a shopping and food guide and kind of some expectations about the nutrition and everything, so that we kind of, you know, set a tone right out of the gate. But it's kind of funny, we have seen different attempts at articulating this material, and we have some trainers who are really good at just saying, hey guys, if you want to succeed, if you want to see good body composition shifts, the way that we approach this, you know, we try to add a hunk of protein at every meal, lots of veggies, we de-emphasize like refined, you know, bread, rice, potatoes, whatever. We do some good fats, and it's real easy. It's real fun. We'll help you do it. It's all upsell. You know, it's kind of uptick, upsell kind of stuff. And then we had one trainer in particular that I'm thinking of that day one, she was basically like, okay, so you're not going to eat any bread, any rice, any pasta, or you're going to fail. And this trainer got a 0% conversion out of that group of people, you know. And I mean, it just set this tone of like anxiety and failure right from the beginning. So it's I think definitely couching it all in the upsell. And you, even though like I think you guys are on a similar page of really trying to get like a 30-day buy-in on folks, like we really want you to be as clean as we can get you for 30 days so you can really experience what the heck is going on. But if there's a little bit of food neuroses there where the person's like, oh, if I can't have a food, then I'll freak out and really, really want it. And so then we drop in the speed bump approach, which is you have to have a bunch of protein, then a bunch of veggies, then your good fat, then you need to wait 5 minutes. And then if you still want your bread, rice, pasta, potatoes, whatever, then you can have it. But you need to wait and eat your way to it. And usually the person is kind of diffused by that point and they don't have a problem. But definitely how you couch it is a big factor in success. And I just have to say that elevator pitch would have to be an elevator ride on like the tallest building in the world in like Dubai or something. So,
well, you, here's the thing. This is our afternoon manner of speaking. If you caught me in the morning after my espresso, I could actually do that elevator pitch in like 14 seconds.
Perfect. Even better.
We'll tighten that up a little bit for the website. It was kind of a late addition to the question, but yeah, I think in general, I think you're right. The approach of, you know, the upsell is really important. And if you're not talking about this in a gym environment, if you're not talking about this with people that have had some exposure to this, and I'm thinking of like people at work or my, you know, family members or my, you know, friend Jen's grandma, when I refuse a piece of garlic bread with the lunch that we're eating, like if you're talking about it in terms of the people that don't have a lot of experience with this, you got to keep it really high level and just sort of, I suppose, don't get too much into it too early, because again, you don't want to scare anybody off. You don't want to bore anyone to tears, and you absolutely don't want to put anyone on the defensive, especially not over a meal itself.
Right. Usually I just say that I'm allergic to whatever the item is, and that kind of puts the whole thing quiet. And if, you know, occasionally we will have somebody kind of raise a little concern about like, well, I don't know if I can eat this way. And one of the things that I've been using is just asking the person, you know, have you ever had like scrambled eggs and some fruit for breakfast? And inevitably somebody at some point in their life has had scrambled eggs and some fruit for breakfast. I'm like, okay, cool. Have you ever had some grilled salmon and a salad for lunch ever in your life? You know, and that's all that you had. And it's like, yeah, at some point I had grilled salmon and a salad. And it's like, okay, have you ever for dinner had like baked asparagus with a T-bone, or, you know, like, again, you know, like, have you had a hunk of meat and some vegetables for dinner ever? And it's like, yeah. And so you've eaten, then I'll turn back and I'll say, okay, then you have eaten a day like this, potentially hundreds of days like this. You simply have not strung them together. So the whole notion that you can't do this is just crap. It's just a matter of like, you know, you can do this. This is easy. If you want to affect some change, then it's waiting right here to do it. And you've actually already done it. You know, it's just we need to now make it consistent and just run with that for a little while. And it diffuses the arguing reasonably quickly, or I just end up running away one or the other. So
well, when we do our whole 30 program with people, with clients or with people on the website, you know, we insist that like your only job for 30 days is to focus on the food choices you're making. That's it. Don't worry about weighing or measuring or how much you're eating or in what proportion, or like just focus on the food choices you're making. That in you know, if you give that long enough, if you give that the full 30 days, you've got enough breakfast, lunch, dinner, snacks, special occasions, special circumstances, traveling for work, like you've got enough of those instances in that 30-day time frame to figure out how to eat like this in pretty much every circumstance. You know, we're about to go on the road for 3 months, and maybe we're a little bit crazy, and I almost wish that we weren't about to announce this sort of on the radio, but we're going to do a full super like 100% strict whole 30 program as soon as we get on the road. And if we can do it while literally living out of Dallas's car for the next 3 months, you really can't tell me that you can't do it with us. So we're going to launch a new program on May 10th. And if people want to participate with us, we'll run it on our website. But, you know, we're going to do this. And there's really, like you said, Rob, there's really no reason why everyone can't figure out how to eat like this, even if it's just for 30 days to get started.
Well, yeah, in the last 2 years, I've been on the road 34 to 36 weekends out of each of those 2 years, so like more time gone than home. Mm-hmm. And I don't have any choice in the matter. Like I'm so gluten intolerant, like even I still end up getting cross contamination even though I'm trying to avoid things like the plague. But more often than not, I'm able, you know, whether it's Mexican food, Thai food, whatever, I'm able to wrangle something together. So, and I love it when somebody, I've been really hammering people lately when they pull the Asian card or something like that. They're like, but I'm Asian, so I need to eat rice. And I'm like, that's BS. You know, my family's from the South. Have you ever seen people eat grits? You know, so it's kind of funny. But that'll be awesome. That'll be great to follow you guys on that.
Yeah, we'll see. I'm anticipating eating a whole lot of, like, eggs and fruit and nuts in the morning when we're camping or something, but you know,
we eat a lot of eggs and fruit and nuts in the morning now.
Yeah,
anyway,
that's so true. That's true.
That's not a problem.
I just have two words: Donner party.
Yeah, I'm not sure either of us have enough like fat on us at this point to make that a wild option, but maybe
there might be some rabbit starvation there. So.
Yeah.
Well, I just want to make sure that people know that you guys are doing nutrition consulting, that they can check that out at the Whole Nine website, which is linked off of our site and off of the consulting page. And the reason why you guys are linked off that consulting page is because I've seen your work and you guys completely kick ass and do phenomenal jobs. So, like, if folks are looking for help with meal plans and just getting all the niggling nuances of their food dialed in, you guys are the folks to go to.
Thank you. Yeah, we've learned an awful lot from hanging out with you and reading your stuff, and it's been a good support system for us. So thank you guys for having us on and for all the promotion and support. We really appreciate it.
Totally. Andy, any closing thoughts?
No, I think we need to say it's episode 26, Rob, and I have no funny jokes for episode 26.
we'll pull out all the stops for episode 27.
we already are old enough to drink as a podcast. We've already turned a quarter century. Like, I got nothing on 26. I don't remember that being a very fun birthday.
No,
not so much. it's unanimous.
I was in Chico, actually. You know what? Actually, my 26th birthday in Chico, I was almost beat up and thrown out of a bar, and the bouncers, two on each side, swung me and threw me into the back of my roommate's pickup.
Wow.
In an arcing, like heaving a bag of sand into the back of the pickup. Yeah, it was pretty spectacular.
Nice.
Were you skinny then, Rob?
I was actually probably about a buck 80, so I was about that's when I was still lifting weights and kickboxing and stuff, so, yeah.
All right.
Cool. Nice.
Well, with that, we thank you, Dallas and Melissa, for coming on the show. Well, hopefully we'll have you back again soon. Next time we will have no technical difficulties to ruin your afternoon.
Gorgeous.
It's been fun. Thank you.
Thank you. We'll talk to you guys soon.
Take care.
Talk soon.
Okay. Bye-bye. Bye.